This is the 2 North Jackson Podcast with news, insights, details, and accomplishments from Alabama's 67 county governments. Hello and welcome to the podcast for June of 2022. Today we'll focus our discussion on prisons, the 94th annual convention, and the upcoming World Games. We'll begin with a visit with the new commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections, John Hamm, who became commissioner on January 1 of 2022 after an almost decade-long career at the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sonny. I appreciate you having me.
And as I mentioned, John became commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections almost exactly 6 months ago. Tell us what you've been doing for 6 months, John, in a job that was right up your career alley, having served as a sheriff and being very active at ALEA and also earlier in career at the Alabama Sheriff's Association. But you walk in the first day to a department that I suspect might just be a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah, walking in, I did have some familiarity with the department, and there was a lot of things that kind of remained the same, but a lot of things that have changed. So spent a lot of time meeting with the individual unit division directors, you know, trying to get updated on what's been happening over the last several years. Of course, there's litigation going on, so got updated on that, just the structure of the department over the last, you know, decade. So spent a lot of time getting that because it is a large organization. So that took a lot of time. And still, there's areas of the department that I haven't really taken a deep dive into that I'd like to. But there's been a few things happening along the way that's kind of set me back on that a little bit. But we're going to get around to them.
Well, with a law enforcement career of over 35 years, you mentioned things had changed in the department. You were assistant commissioner in the department a couple of decades ago, right?
I just want to get it out there that I have been around a long time, but I'm not old. That was a couple of decades ago, 99 to 2003, I was at the department. And some of the people that I knew then are still with the department that have certainly full faith and trust in, that's, you know, part of the leadership team that I've assembled. So it's going well.
Well, one of the things county government has seen in the last 6 months, a very visible change, is the backlog of state prisoners in Alabama's 67 county jails. If we ratchet back a year ago today, we had about 2,500 state inmates in Alabama's county jails. I get a report every Friday. I think last Friday it was in the 80s that were in the Alabama's county jail. So I know you didn't have a top hat and a magic wand. How have you pulled that off?
Well, I think I have a unique perspective on this issue. I can't say knowledge because, you know, people know me and they'd probably disagree with that of my knowledge of, you know, sheriff's offices, county government, you know, and working with you for a while. So I have that perspective and try making the balance between understanding what counties are going through and then also leading the Department of Corrections and our responsibility. So I try meshing those two together. And one of the things, you know, we started looking at during the transition before I took over on January 1st is state inmates in county jails. I mean, that's always been a thing I've kept up with, looked at the numbers, and developed a plan to start drawing those numbers down because it's the department's responsibility and county jails. You know, I've heard you say a couple of times about unfunded mandates from the state. So it's like,
a couple of times, maybe three.
But that's something that I felt and the leadership team that's helping me that we needed to get the state inmates out of the county jail. So made a concerted effort with our transfer division and just started pulling them in.
Well, of course, county government very grateful for that because the budgeting pressure that that puts on counties has been significant and certainly during the pandemic. And one of the things that we were talking before we started that you're experiencing now is a fairly significant decline in your employees compared to even where the department was back during the pandemic. And I know that's a huge challenge for you going forward.
You know, the times we're in, it's kind of tough to hire people in general. And when you think about corrections, most people talk about correctional officers. We have opportunities there to hire correctional officers, but also in our support staff. And that's some of the other state agency issues that we have in common is support staff, that the climate we're in, we have significant openings in our accounting division to the tune of probably 25 to 30. So that creates issues on itself. You can pick any division and we have opportunities to hire people. So it's not only in state government, but it's also, you know, you look around town and you see openings. So we're trying to come up with ways to attract people that want to come into public service.
Well, it's a huge issue at the county level as well, and that is trying to attract employees at a time when everybody's having a difficulty. But for you, the inflow of inmates has sped up because you've moved inmates from county jails more quickly. Certainly, we know the Department of Pardons and Paroles has their own approach to things, but your inmates are not emptying out at a very fast pace either. And at the same time, your employees' numbers are going down. Is there any good news, John?
Well, to your point about the influx, that's one thing about the department that may be a misconception is we do not control anyone that comes in. We take what the court send us, we follow the court orders, and we have no idea how many or where they're coming from. So it's a challenge, you know, where you might have 50 one week, you might have 500 the next week. So it is a challenge not knowing and having any kind of control over the inmates coming into your system. Now, of course, we know them from the county jail, but it is an interesting challenge and opportunity to stay nimble and flexible to deal with that influx. And then the outgo, just a couple of things that release inmates, and DOC really has no control over that. So it puts us in a unique position, but we're headed down the road to make sure we provide a constitutional correctional facility and provide medical and mental health for these inmates and give them rehabilitative and vocational education so when they do get out, maybe we won't see them again.
Well, and I know on top of all those challenges, the department continues to wrestle with a federal lawsuit from the Department of Justice. And I assume you have addressed the problem of getting inmates out of county jails. I assumed you haven't settled that lawsuit yet, right?
That is litigation that's going on, yes.
And of course, one of the visible aspects of that, the Alabama legislature has approved the construction of two new facilities. And I know that's several years down the road, but before those facilities could be constructed and open. But certainly that's one step forward in this federal lawsuit.
Yes, we are moving forward with the construction of the two facilities. We have certainly had good support from the legislature, from the governor, and her office. So we feel good about the posture we're in trying to remedy some of the issues we face. And of course, the prison construction, that's not adding capacity or beds to it, but it'll be certainly more efficient, more safe, more secure facilities, not only for inmates, but certainly staff. It will be a lot safer and secure. And also we're adding, again, vocational education space where we've partnered with Ingram State Technical College. They provide all the vocational training for inmates around the state, so it's a good opportunity.
Well, as you said, it's a complicated issue, requires a complicated solution, and one that's not going to happen overnight. But the 1,000-mile journey begins with a step, and you've had 6 months of walking. And so far from the county level, we want to again voice our support of you. I think you know that personally. We've had a long history of working together on a number of fronts, all the way back when you first got elected sheriff. I remember you coming to the Alabama State House. Both of us had a little more hair and a little fewer wrinkles, but since then, we've walked a journey, haven't we?
We have. That is a circle of events that is certainly interesting because I was sheriff of Barber County, and that was the plaintiff in the lawsuit against the Department of Corrections to remove state inmates from the county jail. And then I went to work for corrections, and that was kind of unique. And then I went to work for Association County Commissions and the Sheriff's Associations. Now I'm back at Department of Corrections, so it's been an interesting circle.
That's right. You were at the Barber County Jail, and it was a plaintiff suing the department about getting state inmates out, and now you become commissioner, and get the state inmates out.
That's right.
So you did put your money where your mouth is, didn't you?
Yeah. What we were wanting them to do, what, 30 years?
Ooh, almost, yeah. 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Almost 30 years ago. Well, John, we appreciate you visiting with us very much. We wish you luck as you continue to tackle the challenges at the department. As we get ready for the 2023 session, you know that we want to be your partner and want to work together with you.
Well, and that's certainly something I appreciate because I know you. And, you know, going forward on a lot of issues, to be partners. And I know when you say we'll partner up on something, I can take that to the bank. And that certainly helps us jointly tackle issues that'll be mutually beneficial.
And we'll have you back in a few months and we'll catch up again. And in the meantime, I know we'll be talking on other issues. So thanks very much for joining us. It's John Hamm, the Commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections. We'll now turn our attention to this year's annual convention in August, when we will begin the general session with a crowded room of elected officials and employees at the county level, and we'll all be talking to each other without talking to each other. Jan Hargrave, a body language expert who has appeared on all the major networks, has helped politicians prepare for debates, has helped lawyers choose juries, and she's going to be at the convention to help us be more effective at the county level. And Jan, thanks very much for joining us for a few minutes.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad to be with you, Sonny, and I'm excited about being with the group in August and teaching them lots of good information about nonverbal communication.
Well, I know that you've written 5 books, and one of those focuses on poker players, and you might kind of say a politician is a poker player. I know that you've given a great deal of advice over the years to people in all walks of life about nonverbal communication.
Yes, you're right. I think now, Sonny, I've been doing it maybe 25 years. I did my graduate research in college. I'm from Louisiana, so I went to University of Louisiana Lafayette and LSU. So I don't know how people in Alabama feel about that. But I did my graduate research in body language and then began teaching classes for attorneys. So initially, I was teaching attorneys how to spot liars and how to spot truth tellers and confidence and nervousness. But then industry realized we need to bring all of this information. Doesn't matter what we do. If we're in a public office, if we're managing a company, we still communicate with other people. And a huge part of our communication is nonverbal communication. In fact, the percentages are this way, 55% of our communication is nonverbal. So when you first see someone, you decide, do I like them or do I trust them? Do I want to have a conversation with them? That is 55% of our communication. Voice inflection is 38% of our communication. And only 7% of our communication is actual face-to-face body language, the words that come out of our mouth. So actions speak louder than words. Anyone can learn it, and I think it's an advantage. It's almost as though you learn another language. You know, we speak English, we speak French, we speak Spanish, we speak German. Why not learn to speak this thing called body language? Because it's going to help them understand how to really delve into someone else's mind or personality before that person even understands they're delving into it. It's an extra added bonus.
Well, as we talk about our annual convention scheduled for August, for those who are planning to come or those who are trying to make a decision, give us a little peek into what the session will be like when we're all together in August.
I'm going to bring them in, and, you know, I do a lot of tests when I'm teaching, too. So I'm just asking the listeners right now, if a guy is rubbing his chin as he listens to you, it is a body language gesture that says that he is totally in agreement with what you're saying. Would you think that that was true? Would you think that that was false? And what about this one, Sonny, if I said, men who jingle the change in their pockets are concerned about their financial situation? Would you think that that was true? Would you think that that was false? Or let me throw a scary one in here. People who tend to use their left hand a lot tend to lie a lot. Would you think that that one would be true? Would you think that that one would be false? So what I do is I like to bring a lot of examples, and I like to show the audience some of the nonverbals so that in their next conversations that they would have someone else figured out before the person actually figures out them. So I take them in and I teach them all the body language gestures of confidence, all the body language gestures of nervousness, all the body language gestures maybe of professionalism. I teach them probably gestures they should not do because I'll teach them how to decipher if someone's being deceptive. So I'll teach them lying gestures too, but they should never, ever do those gestures. I'll teach them as much as I can at the time that they're together because it's going to have an effect on them. I know that after the meeting is over and they have listened to me, they will be in a meeting, they'll be watching television, they'll see someone do a certain gesture and they'll say, oh, I remember Jan taught us that gesture. So the great thing about learning things about body language, you put it into effect that very same day that you learn it, plus the rest of your life, you can use it in some form of fashion. And also, I like to give them the science behind motions, like why is it someone takes the right hand and maybe brings it to the chest? Why is it someone takes the left hand and maybe touches the nose with their left hand? Why is that behavior? Because I don't want to just teach them a gesture. I want to give them the background of why those gestures are and why they mean what they mean. So it's a huge part of communication. And I think that people are missing out if they don't know all the facets of nonverbal communication. You know, we can talk a good game, but if our nonverbals do not match what we are saying, then people do not believe us and we don't appear sincere to them. Like if someone says to you, I like you so much, but their head goes into a no, actions speak louder than words. People will believe motions more so than they will believe words that are coming out of someone's mouth. Does it sound scary yet?
It does, especially when we're talking about everyone who will be there for the opening general session are those folks who interact with the public and other elected officials. And your credibility is the number one token that you have to exchange for achieving the goals that you're setting out to reach. And I think that part will be among the most useful things that can come out of this session. You mentioned a few minutes ago before we started the podcast that it's important to know how to communicate that you're genuine and interested in what the other person is doing.
Right. And while you were saying that, Sonny, what I was thinking of, I even teach people the right and the wrong way to shake someone's hand, because there is a right way and there's a wrong way. When you're getting that first impression with someone, you never want it to be negative, because, you know, we see someone and we can't just go to them and say, well, are you confident? Are you pure? Are you honest? We can't ask them that, but we try to gather that from watching their nonverbal communication so that when someone first appears in that room, we're going to decide. In fact, in 2 to 7 seconds of you seeing someone, you have decided whether you like them, whether you trust them, whether you ever want to have another contact with them. And within 4 minutes of speaking with an individual, you have made a concrete decision of whether you're going to like them for a lifetime or dislike them for a lifetime. So when I teach it, I try to teach it so that the learner, the person in the room, will understand what does their body language send out message-wise the moment that people see them. And then I want to help them understand how to read someone else's nonverbal so that when they're in a conversation and maybe they're getting a negative gesture, what could they do to rectify that and make that person feel more positive to them? So it's kind of a two-way learning streak. It's understanding what you are sending out and also how to read someone else behind that. And then as we talked about the length of time I've been doing it, one of my first major TV appearances, because I work for ABC News and NBC News and CBS, and I was doing Bill Clinton's body language during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So that's how long I've been doing it. Every time that something happens in the news, they typically bring me on and they ask me, I live in Houston, Texas, so my local channel, ABC, NBC here, asked me to come in and talk about what's going on or to analyze the people's body language. So even when President Biden met with Putin about a year ago, still looking at their body language, because you can get so much from even just the way they're sitting. Even when Donald Trump met with Putin, I did the body language there. So I think once the people who are in our audience see some of the things that I saw, when they see these people come back on television, they can read them a little bit better and be more effective in communicating with other individuals. And this may interest them. I've also done Tom Brady's body language. Now he's with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers when we had the Super Bowl here. So you just name it. I have done their body language. And the people always say to me, Jan, I would hate to be married to you. And I tell them, I would hate to be married to me too, because I am certain that I drive my husband crazy. Can you imagine if he just moves a hand a certain way? I'm like, oh, I know what he's going to think about and what he's going to say next. So it's been a fun skill for me to learn and to teach, and I'm going to enjoy teaching it to these people in August.
Well, thanks very much for giving us a peek as to what we can expect in this year's annual convention, again scheduled for August down at the Perdido Beach Resort in Orange Beach. And it's always our largest gathering of the year, and county officials and employees from all over the state are encouraged to be there. And if you've not already registered, please log on to the association's website, alabamacounties.org, to make sure you register and to get more information on the overflow hotel accommodations. We hope that everyone will be there and we'll all learn how to read each other's communication without saying a word. Jan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Sonny. It'll be so fun, and I look forward to meeting everyone too.
Before we gather in Orange Beach for our annual convention in August, the international spotlight will turn toward Jefferson County for the World Games. And we don't know a lot about the World Games here in Alabama, but we've been joined by Jefferson County EMA Director Jim Coker, who is knee-deep in the preparations for the World Games, right?
Good morning, Sonny. Thank you for having me here today.
And we don't know much about it, but I think we have 3,000, 4,000 individual athletes that are coming to Jefferson County, and all of that by itself would be a huge logistical issue, and the EMA director finds himself deeply involved in that preparation, right?
We have been. A quick snapshot of what the World Games is. It is an international sporting event involving over 100 nations. About 3,600 athletes will be coming to Alabama during this time period. This is the first time in over 40 years that this event has been held in this country, in the United States. It was last held in Wrocław, Poland in 2017. This should have been the 21 World Games. COVID did a number to us, and it got delayed a year. So our planning actually started in 2017 when the torch was passed in Poland to the then mayor of Birmingham and to Jefferson County Commissioner Joe Knight on the stage in Poland in front of a very large crowd. And really that is when we became heavily involved, and now we're here 5 years later.
That's right. The world spotlight and the athletes will be here in just a few days. And if you could talk a little bit about the preparation that has to go into an event like this.
First, this event is unlike many other events. This is what's known as a SEER 1 rated event. This is the first time that this has happened in the state of Alabama. With a SEER 1 event, you get a lot of support from the federal government. They do not come in and run it. It's still up to the county to run it. But they bring a lot of assets that we couldn't touch otherwise. One big challenge with this is, unlike a Super Bowl, we have so many venues. We have venues that are operating simultaneously in more than one county, because Shelby County is also included. So one challenge is just to make sure that you've got the logistics in place, that you've got all the assets you need from law enforcement, EMS, transportation. Everything has got to be in place across all these venues every day.
Well, and as you talk, I'm getting a migraine just thinking about everything that's got to be prepared for, all of the unexpected things that could happen. Now, we know athletes are going to have to be trained. You're going to have to respond to their needs. But what about the spectators and the huge problems that could go on? I assume, as an emergency manager, that's part of what you've learned in the profession, is to plan for the unexpected.
You know, one of the unexpected things, and there's several things I'll bring up here. First of all is the language challenges that we may face, because with 100 countries coming in, we have multiple languages. Many of these teams have their own crowds that follow that particular team. So we had to make extensive plans on how to deal with people that we can't just speak to every day. A lot of this is medical, so our medical coalition has really taken a step up front role in all this to get everything going. Some of the other challenges are, what if we have a female patient and a male medic? In some cultures, she can't be treated by a male medic. So that was also part of the planning. And then another very interesting part to me is working with the State Department. Because what if I am an athlete and I come up to you, Sonny, and say, I want to defect to the United States of America. I want amnesty. You can't say, I'm going on break right now, talk to my supervisor. So we've had to train a lot of people in how to handle things like that. It's been a very unique opportunity.
Well, and as you talk about all of that, my head turns to, most people think that the emergency management director is focused only on responding to bad weather. That might have been what emergency management was in Alabama 30 or 40 years ago. That's clearly not what it is today.
You know, overall, if you had to define us, it's to making sure that our public is safe, that our public is responded to no matter what their needs are. The variety in this job now has certainly changed from what it was 30 years ago. In our case, not only do we have really the first very large international sporting event since COVID has begun to wind down anywhere in the world, but we had 7 tornadoes last year. You know, we still have the daily challenges that don't turn off because we're working on the World Games.
Well, and your colleagues in the other 66 counties, they don't have the World Games. But as you mentioned before we started talking, they've got something that's a challenge for them that's not weather related.
Absolutely. And many of these counties are sending their personnel to help us staff our operation. And that is not only just a handshake and here we are to help you, but it's a learning experience for them, because they will go back to their own county because they do have festivals. They have major events along the coast. They have boat races. Pick a county in Alabama. Every single county has some event every single year.
And the EMA director has got to be the person who provides the perspective on all of the different groups or organizations that have to be involved to make something like that function. And that's really at its core an issue of relationship building, isn't it?
It really is. One role of an EMA director is to know the people in the county, to know the resources, to know who to ask. None of us pretend to know it all. You never could reach that level. But you know who to ask, and you're not afraid to ask. So where do I find these resources? That's key.
Well, and knowing who to ask, you talked about the World Games being delayed a couple of years because of COVID and giving you an extra year for preparation. It also impacted a role that you had in the Alabama Association of Emergency Managers. You served almost 2 full years as president. And I wanted to talk a minute or two about that organization and what it has meant to this really explosion of the role of the emergency manager in our state.
You know, COVID taught us a lot of things. We learned how to work remotely. We learned how to use Zoom and Teams and all the other different platforms. That impacted the association because we had to conduct many meetings remotely. We learned how to better use all of these platforms in emergency management. The association, it's a bunch of people who come from a wide variety of backgrounds, but we're all thrown into the same melting pot, I guess, as it were. And the great thing about that is everyone has ideas that I can pick up and use. I can use your lessons, and that is the strength of the association. It comes back to relationships. I don't think that we could do our job now without the strength of this association.
Well, and as you said, some of the peers that you've developed relationships with in other counties will be an integral part of your role in the World Games. And unfortunately, if we have a normal year in Alabama, sometime later this year, we're going to have a bad weather event, and you're probably going to turn and focus your resources on helping those other counties.
Absolutely. We have sent our staff, and other counties have done this as well, from the Tennessee line to the coast of Alabama, because where we live, we will always be subject to some kind of weather event. You know, but the World Games and other events help us build those relationships. Our staff is meeting the staff from other EMAs. They're meeting county staff from other counties. How far does that go when you have a critical need?
It's what the association has been all about. It's why we say 67 counties, one voice. What happens in Jefferson County affects all of us. And what happens everywhere else affects Jefferson County. And we're excited about the World Games. We're excited about the spotlight it's going to put on Alabama. And we wish you good luck in what we know will be a very hot and challenging experience in early July.
You know, one way that we look at this, when you drive into the state of Alabama from any surrounding state, on the interstate sign, you see the home of the World Games. This is a statewide event. This really does impact every county in the state. It happens to be in our county, but we are pulling assets and knowledge and experience from everybody else.
Jim, thank you for joining us on the June edition of the 2 North Jackson podcast, and we're grateful for your leadership and excited to know that others around the state will be helping ensure that Jefferson County and the state of Alabama puts their best foot forward as the host of the World Games. And this concludes our June podcast, and we look forward to visiting with you again in July.